go to thecognitiverampage.com. Feel free to contribute, donate, keep fueling the change, whatever it is that you guys can do to help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support and, of course, your contributions. Love you.
Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. My book, The Cognitive Rampage, A Scientific Approach to Self-Discovery, Change, and Life Optimization, is now available on Amazon. What I do in the book is I fuse the latest research from the cognitive, behavioral, social, environmental, and biological sciences. It's not just motivational fluff and wordplay. Now, I do talk about my own story, so there's some kind of inspiration in there, but I'm not just spinning words and hyping you up with motivational fluff. Whether you need a life change, simply enjoy self-exploration and optimization, want to discover new hidden passions, or reduce the life-altering effects of toil, anxiety, depression, all of those issues, this book is for you. This book is not a cookie-cutter method of steps to follow. You'll customize the scientific framework with your own personal beliefs to build your authentic change. That way you assimilate it faster and quicker. It's not just copying my beliefs and telling you step one, step two. These will come from your beliefs as how you extend and build the foundation upon this framework. You'll use this framework throughout your whole life, through every change, and through every age. These are not empty words of motivational spin. This book is an experience. The Cognitive Rampage is based in science and is built from your beliefs. It's a path to help you unleash your desired change. You can apply this method on your own with no harmful side effects. You can simply go to Amazon.com, search The Cognitive Rampage, and you'll find the second edition there, as well as the Kindle version as well. Welcome to Cognitive Rampage. See, that's where I'll cut it. For those of you that didn't get to hang out with us pre-podcast, I was just playing a little music just to remind me a little bit where I came from, what I've been through, and remind me why I do it. Because there's other people out there that have been through some difficult shit too, and have made it through to the other side. This rampage is kind of impromptu. I can't say I necessarily planned to do this one, really, especially this quick or this soon. My notes usually pile up, and I'm a little early coming on this one, but just a couple places I've been at and just letting you know where I've been at mentally, right? I posted in there about a 10-year journey I've been on, if you will, for competence, but and love. I kind of shortened it to love and optimization, but I'll get to that in just a little bit. But I'm packed up out of here. You may see behind me. I am out of here. I have moved out of the studio, by the way. If you've been listening to the podcast way back since 2013, I have moved out of the podcast studio due to a lot of Dr. Jack Cruz's research and evidence that he puts out. And if you've listened to those podcasts as well, he gets on to me, right, that I'm sitting in a room of death, if you will. So I tried to move to a place where it's open. I have sunlight in front of me on both sides to try to at least combat some of it. I'm wearing my glasses still, so I'll get beat up for that. But I got to read. It's hard for me to see sometimes. Speaking of reading, when I get to the love portion of this rampage, I'm going to read from an article. I'll post a link to that article on this as well as a comment on social media and when we post it as a podcast on iTunes. I'll get to that article about the history of love because love, I think, is impactful. And if you've listened to this podcast and what I say a lot about love and telling people I love them when I get off the phone or when I get off the podcast, you'll maybe see where that can be somewhat of a critical error, but depends on where it comes from sometimes, but I'll get to the love part at the end of this. I'm sure it will hit flush as I posted on the cognitive dissonance that we all have about love or the hope for the faith, right? You can include faith and hope and love, right? Even scripture talks about of the three of those, love is better, but we'll cover some of that when I read the article. So got a little flow state nervousness about reading the article live on air, right? If I'm just talking a rampage and I have no problem, but I'm about headed out of here. I'm leaving the West Coast, See, I was tangential, but I found my way back. I'm leaving the West Coast out of here, headed back across the country to drive. I'm going to leave tomorrow, probably about 5 a.m, and start my venture from the West Coast back across to the East Coast. And we'll see. It's exciting, though. I came out here for about 6 months and been around the desert, been experiencing all types of love, really, on all angles, from people to nature to friends. But again, it keeps circling back to the love part. But since I've been out here, this is actually where I came out and finished the book as well. I finished the second edition of the book out here. I was in the middle of the cross-country drive and came out here to finish it and kind of put me in a mind state as well about some things I was going through in my life at the time that were quite traumatic to me. My beliefs, at least in my perceptions, were holding them there. It was difficult, but we came through the forest, came through the woods, and beautiful to be back in the light again, to be honest. And for those of you out there going through something like that, the light will come. You'll get through that and challenge the perceptions. But anyway, being out here kind of reset me in a way and pushed me to a path of a different direction as well. Things that I've always kind of moved fluidly in my life like that. I've been blessed enough, I think. You could call it blessed enough or lucky enough or risky enough. I don't know. Mix it whatever you want to call it. But I've tended to just chase, you know, what I love to do, where the passion, where the moment is, and move with. And there's some good and bad that come with that, right? There's no perfect life, my mother loves to tell me. And, you know, whether it's the 9 to 5 and staying home and staying in a location or traveling about, and I'm here to tell you that that's right, that there's no perfect life, that there's ups and downs that come with being open to avenues. Most of my life, if I've had an opportunity or had a enthusiasm for something, I tend to chase it and went after it. And I guess those books were part of it. And, you know, 10 years ago, if you read the first edition of the book, I talk briefly about my life, my childhood, my teen years, and briefly across my wild 20s, if you will. I ended up going on a walk about, you know, about the age 26, if you want to call it, and shed my entire life completely down to nothing, really. And spent 2 years walking around doing all odd jobs, sleeping on linoleum floors and in different states, just kind of experiencing life. You know, I shed a whole nightclub image type thing that I had going on. It was quite a persona, but shed all that and walked about and kind of considered myself on some journey, if you will, even using that language, now that I've come to it almost 10 years later, calling it or describing it as a journey is rather cliche. And, I don't know, not something I'm a fan of much anymore, but, anyway, in a search for this optimization, right? This is another word that we tend to use a lot today. It seems, right up there with the words like biohacking and optimization, right? These are words that if you walk into the self-help world, okay, I'm just going to umbrella it down, okay? They have used the tyranny of words to congregate so many different groups now of, you know, life development, personal development, you pick it, right? Coaches and helpers out there have definitely found a way to enhance and pollute the environment by overpopulating it with the tyranny of our vocabulary, what we call something to try to appeal to certain people. But whatever this quest, this journey, this hunt, this search of mental health optimization is where I'm going to stick to. Okay, this is my realm, the mental health side. I'll throw some tidbits in there about physical optimization, et cetera, but there's some much more masterful people than I to search out for the physical and the biomechanical, like Audi and functional patterns. But for me, I stick to the mental side. So for me on this mental health optimization, because look, I'm just going to be honest. When I went out on that walkabout, I had checked off some boxes that they tell you you're supposed to check off, but I'd done it in some scrupulous ways and was in a place. I was in a wicked, wicked place, if you will, when I left at 26. And now being 36, this is 10 years later. So in this quest for mental health, along the way, I ended up getting a psychology degree, if you will, became a mental health counselor, and really dove into the textbook versions of everything, right? Understanding that psychology is basically theoretical in nature, unless it's linked to something biological, or nowadays it's brain testing and brain imaging and neuroscience seems to be the hacking way to all of it, right? Maybe this is the era to the death of psychology, perhaps. But diving into those contextual journeys many times, the readings, the journals, the articles, research, etc., really enlightened me to another side of opportunity, of possibility, really. And, you know, experiencing corruption along that way too. And it really spun me for a loop, right? So 10 years, right? I became this competence chaser, if you will. I wanted to learn as much as I could, right? I became this curious child, returned to that mind state, if you will. I write about that in the book as well, about being curiously hopeful and optimistic of why, right? And not so concrete in beliefs of what things are, what things aren't as a way, right? But writing that book, right, you can use it on many levels. It can help you optimize, if you will, of what you already got going. But especially if you're in a dark place, if it's a place of despair, a place you want to change, something that you need drastic, is really what the first edition and the second were sort of geared to, were those people that were kind of at the end of the rope. But then it turned out it was able to help a lot of people in other realms too that weren't just there. So, but again, like I say, it's my own perception of my own meandering in this amazing human experience. Other than that, so it helped me put together a lot of concepts that pulled me from a darkness and a narrative that I had shaped from behaviors I had done, actions I couldn't forgive myself for, anger, all these other kinds of emotions, right? We could dive down to the psychology of it. And for me, I just said, look, if this is what I'm being talked to about, if this is what I'm being told, I need to go learn it for myself. And imagine that, if I do that, I tend to go with both feet and dove all the way in and gathered a nice lump sum of student loan debt along the way, and basically said, okay, I got what you're saying here, which is pretty much open to interpretation of the person. And that's kind of why I wrote the book, was kind of a master's degree in mental health, you know, is what I had kind of learned at the end of it in our normal people terms, if you will. I hate to use normal people, but those that try to stay away from vocabulary that seems like you're trying to personify this very intelligent person. And it's hard to cross over some of that language they use in that side into our modern day language and speak straight to you. But at the end of 10 years, right, of talking to so many people smarter than myself, reading all the books, right, doing what I was told to a way, and then doing what my interest took me to, and then my thoughts, right? And I'm going to reference Orlando Perez on this podcast, who has been in my thoughts lately. And I meant to reach out to you, brother. So shout out to you, Orlando Perez. He was on the podcast back when we were in the studio. I forget what number, but look up Orlando's podcast and you'll see a different mind frame of myself then and how I'm talking today. You know, a part I've come to live in the cognitive rampage, if you will, is this constant hunger for more competence to know, right? To know this, to experience this, to gain some sort of confidence toward this, right? And when you dive into words and their meanings and how we apply meanings to words, mind you, it's how we communicate to get points across. But words that we choose to group a set of behaviors or feelings or emotions, right? They don't necessarily define what those things are. We just, as a whole or as a society or as a group, just determine that that's what that means, right? And so when I use words like enthusiasm, interest, confidence, when we use these types of words, you got to understand the bearing that they have to be so subjective to the person, right? It's a state of being, if you will, that has multiple definitions from the experiencer, from the person that's experiencing them. But I've also found that you can't know it all. That sometimes, well, I'll stick with sometimes, that what I've discovered is you have to keep feeding this so much and continually, it becomes this optimization, as if you're going to reach a point, as if you're going to arrive one day, right? What is that moment when you have arrived? And I will speak a little physically too. So say you have arrived biomechanically perfectly. Now what, right? Now, what do? We have to continue to work on that, right? It's something we're continuing to chip away at. Well, the same idea mentally, right? You're not going to arrive at this place. To think that you're going to acquire all the competence of the human experience is irrational. I mean, what goes away and what fills up, right? If the Dunbar number is real, right, we can only remember, what is 150 or 200-something people, and then some information gets moved out. If we're aware of the capacities of our mind, how much can we really retain that we know, and how much changes over time? See, I wrote this thing down that I'm going to try to read, but after the 10-year journey, if you will, I kind of came to the idea that in order to know, I have to know what I don't know, and I also know that I'll never know it all. And what I know is subject to change over time. So to continue to be knowing, I have to keep finding what I don't know to keep knowing. It never fucking stops. It becomes this chasing your tail. You learn something and something is transformed. You learn something else and something is transformed. It becomes noise to a point. And if you mix that with a belief that you can optimize to a point to where you're performing at what they love to call in athletes is peak performance. If we're functioning at a peak performance, it sounds good. But one, how do we measure that peak performance? And there's so many variables that influence our human existence that we know so little about, not just in a biological standpoint, not just how the brain works or how the body functions or how we function biomechanically. Even now, he says that he's a novice, if you will, and trying to understand it and learning as he grows on. And that's a master in that area. We can talk about spirituality as being jokes and mythical and not meaning anything and based on other ideas. But we can't say that they still don't have an influence because of those that do believe it. We can say that beliefs don't matter, but whatever you believe in, even if it's a disbelief, then we are still harboring a belief for something, and that belief is thus then powerful enough to motivate you to continue to do what you do. We can argue that these things have no basis, but we can't argue that they're not impactful to the human experience or our development when we include our environment. Not to mention Cruz's evidence again of EMF and all kinds of other social or environmental influences that affect our biology, that then affect our cognition. See, all of it goes hand in hand, and to be able to measure all of that, the impacts of all of it over time, we don't know. So to operate at peak performance may sound good, but is it something we really want to do over time? Does that actually shorten our lives? If we run an engine at peak level, does it last longer than an engine that's running on the average speed? Or do you do more damage by not running at optimal performance, right? You see what happens. You end up going down a circle trail. Coffee's bad. Coffee's good. Dairy's bad. Dairy's bad. But the interchanging of what is good as what is bad is based on certain discoveries and certain researches. You can get so lost in a web to where I have arrived, or I'm even okay right now, becomes so distant, because the more questions you ask, the more that you learn, the more you basically learn you don't know shit. Are we flexing our cerebral muscles just the way that we're flexing our physical muscles? Does it stem from some insecurity or a need to fit the mold passed down from an evolutionary construct? Meaning we will only be able to lift so much. We're only able to know so much. Are we simply creating knowledge spots? And how much do we lose when we gain? Is there a limit to cerebral muscle storage? So to self-optimize is to indirectly say that something is dysfunctional. Could we possibly just need to believe that nothing is wrong with us? You see, when you believe you have to optimize, you get to a point to where you indirectly are saying that I am not fulfilled. I am not okay. Something is wrong. Something is dysfunctional. So
If we're continually chasing the competence to learn more that we don't know, we're continually telling ourselves that something must be wrong with us, and masturbation is what we're doing. I must be better. I must be optimal. I must be healthier. I must walk properly. I must eat properly. I must live properly. All of these are based in irrationalizations buried beneath ideas enforced through evolutionary human concepts. Could we possibly just need to believe that nothing is wrong with us? See, if we're asking the wrong questions, what if nothing is wrong? What if what is wrong is that we believe something is wrong? Now, here's that cognitive dissonance. I told you I'd hit you right in it flush. If your response to any of this is, no, that's bullshit. Something's wrong because what? Because you feel it? Because you think it? Because you know it? See, it's still based in a belief. So if the belief is what is holding you there to believe that something must be wrong with you, and then what happens when we do change something, when we evolve, right? When we make the change, all that really happens is we change our beliefs. So what we do is we spend time gathering enough evidence to then justify ourselves that we can change a belief, and that's when change occurs. So many people leave change to a process. They talk about it being a process. Give me some time. I'm working it out. Really what you're saying is I'm building evidence and gathering evidence in my research to see if it's okay to change my belief. Because what I've experienced in the past has concreted this belief. So if we have a belief of any kind that somehow roots to the point that we have to mentally optimize, if we have to optimize what we're doing, this belief is indirectly saying that we are not okay, that something is wrong or could be better, if you will. If we're saying that, then that is a perpetual question that we'll continue to ask your entire fucking life. And if we believe that, how long do we spend chasing our own tails for the idea of a mental health optimization to a peak performance level to where once we arrive and then we will be okay? Once all of society has come to this realization and then we will be okay. You see, the perpetual race is what you become. You become a perpetual racer in the race of an irrational place. So ask the opposite question. Rather, how can I get better? Rather than how can I optimize this? How can I be more efficient, more functional? Think of all the words that are used. How can I be less dysfunctional? What if I just say, the problem is that I think something is wrong. And if we continually think something is wrong, we will believe something is wrong. And if we believe we can get better, or optimize on these subjective levels of whatever the fuck that means. Because I promise you, if you get better in one level, you're going to lose in some other levels. Time you spent optimizing your body is time you did not spend socializing with those you love. And if you died in a week, would that day of training been more important than to share the time with those you love? I'll get to the love part. What's the measure of the stress that we put on ourselves to maintain a schedule, to maintain a life of biohacking optimization? What is the indirect cause of the stress to keep this schedule doing to the opposing sides of us we can't see? Where's the balance, right? Because wherever you put your time is where time goes away from somewhere else, because you don't have time as a luxury. So if we believe and spend most of our time trying to optimize or become better, then we spent most of our valuable time on this planet believing something is fucking wrong with us rather than enjoying what we are in the moment. Than just being. Than being present. We spend so much time frivolously without thinking what belief this time that we are giving away. Because when you die, it's you in the casket, bruh. Sis. It's just me there. So did you volunteer the time to optimize something, believing something was wrong most of the time when really you should have just enjoyed the time? Then again, we don't want to shoot all over ourselves, right? You see the path I can walk you down. But in my 10 years of chasing this mental state of optimization, I've still experienced life on the ups, the downs, the anxieties, the depressions. If we believe that we can reach a state of mental health optimization to where we are a finely tuned mental health machine, then perhaps you may have to just turn off life for a while. There's people, like I say many times, walking around in the mountains of the Himalayas, trying to remove themselves and detach from all things possible, and still they struggle to reach that self-actualized point, the detachment from all others, the detachment from things and influence. Is it instinctual to chase better? See, we use words like development and technology. Again, the shelter behind words of behaviors as our group as a whole is where many find, and many corrupt people find, safety as they operate what they do. See, we find safety behind our own dialogue of irrational influence, behind our beliefs, so we feel safe too. If we're to stay mindful in the here and now, the inner dialogue needs to be strategic. See, I was pondering the other day, if you are to stay mindful, right, that's practicing in the present, right? You can do it right now. This is what it's an easy application to say. The sun is shining, the sky is blue, I am live, the television is on in front of me, the coffee has gone cold. We are talking about being mindful, that is being in the present, right? Try to go a whole day, if you will, and not talk in the past or present tense. See if you can simply talk in the present. Watch how much you'll stop saying. Watch how much you'll quit talking. I challenge anybody out there, if you can do it, see how long you can go and simply speak in the present. But see, the downside of the mindfulness, right, this practice, is you can't be strategic. We're almost walking in some idea of being in the now. I'm functioning here. I'm with you. Right. And this is their answer to depression, anxiety. Their answer to the human experience is to be mindful. Well, if I'm to be mindful, then I can't be strategic in my own life. I can't even plot my own beliefs, much less explore them. If I'm constantly focusing on being in the present, I can't be strategic. I can't think about the next thought or behavior and how it may influence the next thought, or how I can learn from my past behavior or others' past experiences to then change something. I leave the chessboard, essentially. When you become mindful, you leave the chessboard, but you see that can lower anxiety if it's too much, but it can also bring you right in the present moment of anxiety. To be strategic is not to simply observe or state what's happening in the present. If we can allow our inner language to evolve, to be proactive, instead leaves us reactive mind state. So if we're mindful in the present, we simply are going to be reactive to what nature is doing, what the environment is presenting to us. But to be strategic is to move beyond that. But again, do we fall down into the fall into the deep hole of the strategic thinking so much, the optimization thinking again, that once we find ourselves chasing our tail again, going, we have to get better, we have to get strategic. Again, to be strategic means that something's wrong, that we have to then win something, conquer something, obtain something, change something, improve something. You know, sometimes I look back and go, fuck, I wish I had eaten the other pill. It's hard sometimes when you dive down that hole of, I got to know why and I got to know this. There's so many times I wish I could have went back and been like, nah, just leave me asleep. It seemed easier sometimes. But I think at the end of eating the other pill, I'm calling it the end because I've spent 10 years chasing some sort of level of optimization and have studied them, read their books, read the other sides, and listened to so many people talk about what that means. I've also heard a lot of people talk about what love means. I've listened to myself pontificate a few videos or whatever you call them about what love is and what love means. There's a history to love that goes back to Plato and Aristotle and the ideas of it and what it meant. See, our era is the era of the romantic love. The idea of a passionate connection, if you will. See, back then they used to refer to it as madness. As if love got a hold of you and you were done. Even the Bible references the idea of love in that nature. You can go way back in the history of where love comes from and the ideas of it. There's arguments in scripture where it references sounding like a homosexual love between Jonathan and David. But that was more like a brotherly love. That's what people would say. So the subjective nature, the influence, right? The idea, again, where we use words to try to group in behaviors, feelings, emotions, experiences. We try to huddle all that under one little simple word. And that's the arrogance of human beings, if you ask me, because it's so subjective, right? You see, a lot of times I talked about on this podcast that people don't fall in love. And trust me, this never went over good at barbecues or something like that. People stop inviting me. That's the other thing, by the way. If you jump down this competence circle and you become the documentary watcher, the unveiler of all things unknown, you will slowly lose your social circle because you'll just be trying to hang out at a barbecue. Somebody's trying to chill and have a hot dog and you look at them and go, do you know what's in that, right? You know where that comes from. And you start on this whole spiel, right? Because we can't unlearn what we know. People go, hey, man, I'm just trying to hang out, you know? I'm trying to watch the game. Like, oh, let me tell you about sports in the game, right? You become that person. That's what happened to me. I became that person as I uncovered all this stuff. As I woke up from the other side, it was going, holy shit. No, you got to understand, we're all functioning. It's dysfunctional. All of this, right? It just unveiled. Like, you looked under the covers like, motherfucker. Oh, no. And that hits you square in the cognitive dissonance. That makes life hard. It makes it hard to get up and go to work the next day. It makes it hard to give a fuck about anything. Sometimes it makes it hard not to give a fuck about anything except trying to wake everybody up about what's happening. Kind of like the adventure I've been on for a while is going, hey, what the fuck? The unity, if you will. So when I talked about love, a lot of times I would say people don't fall in love. People fall in fear. No, Adam, all that doesn't sound good, right? See, we're in the era of it sounds good. Whether it has consistency or validity, we're okay if it lacks a little bit of that. But if it sounds good and it makes me feel good, well, yeah, I like that. Remember, you can't have a feeling unless you have a thought. So if it makes me think a good thought, which you created the thought, so nothing makes you, but you create the thought that makes the feeling. So this idea of love has been entertained for centuries. But see, I talk about people fall in fear because what I used to say is imagine two people on the other side and all trying to play capture the flag. And capture the flag is safety, validation, or love. And each person has their approach to this. They're approaching the flag with their shield in some way, moving in certain ways. And when you meet somebody that perhaps has gone through the same experiences of this love idea with you or in life, they move like you do. They approach this flag cautiously, or they throw caution to the wind, or that medium between wherever you two fall. You're afraid of this, they're afraid of that. What do we even say? Oh, they've shared their deepest inner fears with me. They shared their darkest moments with me. So we find love, if you will, and connectivity when we share those dark things about us, when we are who we are and they accept us for it, right? Some people use sacrifice in love. That's sacrificing yourself for others. All these notions to me sound very painful, for one. Kind of scare me. But if these two people are moving toward that flag with the same manner, we start to say, hey, yeah, that's how I move too. Yeah, that's how I believe too. Yeah, I've experienced that, and this is my takeaway from that experience, you too. We call it a connection. But perhaps it's two people sharing similar fears that are then validating, or at least making those fears then seem not present. Maybe those two people provide that shade for the other person in a similar way. So it feels good because it creates safety, creates thoughts. It validates our existence. You see, when you're stressing for the love or the acceptance, where does that come from? See, I've talked about a lot on podcasts where I say where anger comes from. See, all humans want to be loved and accepted at some level. Then above the love and acceptance is hurt. When we don't get that, that creates a fear, because when we're hurt, it makes us afraid. We then create assumptions that build to expectations. Then we have resentments. And at the top of that is anger. So no one has an anger problem, right? I say they have a hurt problem. Well, then hurt comes from wanting to be loved and accepted. So to answer the idea of what is love and where does it come from, you got to know the history of it. But if it's based on being loved and accepted, why do we then feel the need to be loved and accepted? Perhaps because we all share a fear of death. See, earlier evolutionary points, we had to bond together. We had to become one in a unit to function, to live. But now those units have gotten so big, we can barely sustain ourselves being so many gathered in so many small locations. So we go back to the idea of balance, right? People would throw balance in there. It's a balance, Adam. Love is a balance between what and where is the measurement? Show me the scale. Show me the scale that shows me my life is balanced cognitively, biomechanically, spiritually. Show me the measurement. We can't measure it. But then again, doesn't mean it doesn't have influence, because if we believe it, if it's in our culture, if it's in our society, it still has influence. We can't deny the fact just because we don't have a spiritual meter reader. Or what that even means, right? It's so open to the interpretation. And so is love. So when I say people fall in fear, aren't you afraid to lose them? Aren't you afraid when you meet them? As you're cultivating that love, are you falling in love? See, back in ancient times in Greek, to fall in love meant was to fall as in to die, that you fell into madness. But we don't think about the words. We say, oh, I'm falling in love, as if it's this place of rest and romance and passion. It is so open to interpretation what love is. As we tell each other we love each other, or you tell your partner that you love them. Do you love them to an extent to which, as if they did this, you would no longer love them? Is there unconditional love, or is that even possible for human nature? Possibly with your kids, right? But is there a line? Is there a line in the romantic love? See, when you separate the ideas of where love comes from, it has different ideas. Romantic love, brotherly love. Well, yeah, there's all kinds of different love, Adam. Oh, well, then we're left to the subjective interpretation of however we want to apply the tyranny of that word in any moment. I love the lines when they go, well, I love you, I'm just not in love with you. What the fuck does that mean? Nothing. It means absolutely nothing. But from my gathering of the historical reads and the subjective nature of it and knowing it, I can tell you what it circles back to me for. Really is to love your neighbor like you love yourself. And I think maybe that's how we all really live, because if we all don't really love ourselves or have a confidence in ourselves or are able to be on our own existence, perhaps that's why we can't love our neighbor like we love ourselves. Or maybe we do. Maybe that's the problem, is as much love as we give ourselves, as much love as we're willing to give our neighbor. A brotherly and a sisterly love. A care for the human species to evolve to another level as a whole. Not in a micro dimension, but on a macro level, possibly. But is that love then subject to what I say based on their beliefs, their religious beliefs, their cultural beliefs? I'll love you if you believe as I believe. It becomes a syringe that we can poke when we want to into the other person and extract or inject. I love you. I don't love you. And then if we love them, but not them, we then are categorizing and ruling out. Now we have levels of love. I love them. I'm not in love with you. How do we love others if we don't love ourselves? Maybe being aware is a word I like to use, but we're so novice in what we know still, and we become so fucking arrogant. Just because we don't know this means all of this must be true. I have watched the humility of man dissipate to a puddle-like level when it used to be oceans. The humility we're willing to express, it has become a fad. Even in my own book, as I talk about humility, this fad about being humble and present and mindful and sharing and love, it has become a trend. It's become a brand. Aren't we just flexing our mental muscles just like the person flexing their biceps? What's the difference? If a person believes something, then that is a dogma within itself. So if you believe you know something, then that knowing something is subject to change, and you already know that. So to say that you know something is to say, I know this for just a little bit, but I know it'll change in 100 years, 1,000 years, or 50 years, because we don't know it all. Nor can we know it all. Nor can we define the open subjective nature of the human experience to whittle it down to it must be this and it must be that. You won't find the answer to what is wrong, because I'm telling you, nothing is wrong with you. You can chase your tail. You can chase mental health optimization and biohacking to keep you distracted from the reality of what it is we live in and to the idea that we ultimately will die. So connecting fears with other people if it makes you feel better, I guess. But remember, what you feel is what you think. What you believe creates all of those. You can dive down to all of the questions. Ask them why. Who cares? Ask why. You know, my response after 10 years of why this happens and why society does this or that, who fucking cares? You don't know. You can't answer it. Do you know why this turns purple when the earth rotates to a certain? No, I don't know. Nor will I know it all. And the more I seem to learn, the more shittier it appears to me. And I don't like the perception that I'm creating about the more I know. I won't be perfect. Sounds good, right? But yet we strive for it every day. We use words like alone to attach ourselves to people we know we shouldn't be with. We allow fear to perpetuate nearly everything we do in our lives. Fear of being alone. Fear of not living what I'm supposed to live. I did a video about inner dialogue the other day, of something to be aware of. You see, many people exist in their own mind with this one streaming line of dialogue they believe to be their thoughts. And they dredge down this fucking screenplay every day. But there's only one character in this screenplay, and it's just them. So every thought and opposing thought and thought they believe to be what they're thinking in a stream, they're just operating on this automative response. Culture tells me to do this, I do this. Perhaps this is why you find the person who goes, yeah, I got married. Yeah, I had the kid. Yeah, I did what social constructs told me to do. Yes, I do that. And then they wake up, right? The 40-year crisis, right? That breakdown. That's what you always hear about, which isn't real, by the way. We create that. Midlife crisis is not real. We create this idea. But then that unfolding of, wait a minute, I didn't do anything I wanted to do. I didn't chase any passion for a long time. I didn't have as much fun. I did what they said to do, and I just operated in the stream of, I woke up today, this person in my head tells me to do this, it tells me to do this, and I like this, and this is where I stay. But awareness is being aware that our inner dialogue to ourselves is naturally combative. It has to be. It has to be combative to weigh your options of whether I can walk through that sliding glass door or not. I have to go, is that open? It's not open. I have to open it, and then I can walk through it. Your brain functions at that micro level. I promise you, it has all processes that work like that. They function so quickly. So the dialogue inside, be aware, is naturally combative, and it's combative for you. It assists you. But if we're unaware that our inner dialogue is naturally combative, and then one day we realize, holy shit, it's combative, and it's generally when we're experiencing a choice or toil or something to think about or something we need to change or something we have to optimize or something we have to get better or something we need to never do again, right? This is where those thoughts start, that we must be better, that we're not okay. In that experience, and then it can hit you like a shockwave going, holy shit, I'm indecisive. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do, because you've just been awoken to the voices in your mind that are actually combative, which have been that way the entire time. But when you can be aware and be open to it, and then make yourself the observer of the two voices. I know this sounds crazy. I know how it sounds, right? The whole world tells you. You're hearing voices, you know, you hear them in your head. You talk, this says no, this says yes. The one's like, don't do that. The other one's like, ah, fuck it. You know, you talk back and forth, right? But nobody's talking about it because we don't want to seem crazy. That's why you're laying in bed at night staring at the ceiling. Who are you talking to? Talking to yourself back and forth. But when you can be aware of it, then the disagreements between the two sides aren't so traumatic. You can allow it to go. You can ride the wave, if you will, of both sides of the combative voices that are telling you this or that. You can write them down and be aware. Then when you become the observer of this technique, then you can just listen. And your truth will eventually reveal itself. But in that awareness, you can ride deeper rather than just running that same screenplay, that same one character monologue that you've been doing about what you do in life and why you do it, why you say you love. I'm in love, so I did this. I do this so I can do this, but why, right? But be aware. When you dive down into asking why about what you believe, why you're in love, why you do what you do, why we're even here, the purpose of life, when you start to walk down these, you can reach a place where you become chasing your tail and you flex your cerebral muscles so arrogantly that you completely miss the human experience. And you'll look up and say, none of this fucking changed. None of it really even mattered. Was I even present? But again, beware. Being present means you can't be strategic. Know what you say and why you say it. Question it, but also know that that line needs to be drawn somewhere where you do stop and say, wait the fuck on. Nothing is wrong with me. That's the question I've been asking, and that's the statement I've been saying most of the time these days. And when I have found an ease come over me because I'm creating new thoughts, new feelings. But I think when we try to pigeonhole, pinpoint, or nail down what this human experience is, what it's about, what we'll know, and some idea of arrival one day, it's arrogant. The vast openness of what we don't know is much, much bigger, to an infinite times two, if you will, than what we do know. You won't learn it all. You won't reach an idea of mental health optimization, supreme functionality. And then what? Then you won't experience life anymore? Whatever that is to you. It is what you make it, y'all. At least that's the beautiful part about this life to me. Love you.